Your weekly pulse on the Milwaukee Bucks, straight from a Bucks legend. This is Here District with Marcus Johnson, alongside his son and 1995 NCAA champion, Chris. Here's MJ.
All right, welcome everybody. Here District, Marcus Johnson, Chris Johnson, the only father and son combination duo to win a national championship in the NCAA at the same school. That's the one qualifier, UCLA. So that's our claim to fame. And we got another guy here that's got a pretty solid resume in terms of claim to fame, Chris. So look, we're excited to join by this guy. He's a comedian. He's an author. He's a social media star. His latest comedy special, Neighborly, is out on YouTube. It's funny. He talks about just some great insight about the Midwest. That's his whole shtick. I love the Midwest too. Charlie Behrens, man, welcome to Here District, man. We appreciate you being here.
You guys, it's an honor to be here. Thank you for having me. And I gotta say, me and my dad are the only father son duo to hit our thumb with a hammer and say the same cuss words in unison. There you have it. In the same order.
Well, that's something that they'll never be able to take away from you, Charlie. That legacy with your dad. Dr. Behrens, if I'm correct, right?
He's a doctor. You got that. Yeah.
What kind of doctor is he?
He's over there at Children's Hospital, and he's worked there his whole career. And so he works on children. He's an anesthesiologist.
Okay.
So he gives kids drugs, but when his own son walks into a beer bottle that his brother threw at his forehead and cuts his forehead open, does he get any anesthesia, or does my dad give me a shot of brandy and tell me to wipe the belt while he's sitting on the kitchen table? That's the real question.
No, that's funny. That's funny, man. So speaking of your family, 12 kids, and you're the second oldest of 12. Now, how does it shake out between boys and girls and all that?
Yeah, so we got 4 boys total and then 8 girls.
Nice, okay.
Yeah.
It kind of mixed in together, boy, girl. Is it the boys? See, you got you and an older brother, but after you?
3 boys.
Okay.
And then 4 sisters, 1 boy, 4 more sisters. So my younger brother, John, is just surrounded by 4 women on each side.
Right.
But they can all fight like boys.
So. Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, and it was hilarious for me listening to your special, talking about how your mom would inform the family at prayer time that there's another little Behrens on. come on up to prayer time, and I like the cage free. You guys were like, grew up cage free and out there just roaming the streets and everything, man. But how much input do your siblings have in terms of your humor? Do they help remind you of like the funny story? I've got 4 sisters. I grew up with 4 sisters and me. So 5, you know, it pales in comparison to you. But man, you know, just the hilarity around the household was nonstop for us too. So I can imagine, man, that they've got to be a great resource for you and some of your comedy.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're funnier than me, and some of them are not, but
I got one like that. Yeah.
Every Christmas we do this thing where we have like a secret Santa, you know, cause you're not buying 12 gifts. We're not.
Right.
We're not
sure.
And, but we have for each one of those kids, like whoever your secret Santa is, you don't just get them a gift. You have to write them a roast. We call it gimmicks. So every Christmas, one person is roasting another person before they give the gift. And it's not a successful Christmas unless it ends in someone crying. We need that.
fact.
We need to go past comedy into the tears.
Abject humiliation, right? All right.
Uh-huh. We need someone to cross the line. We need it.
Is there one sibling that you could pretty much bank on that's going to break down and shed the tear? You could break them down easier than the others. And is it a boy or is it a girl?
Usually it's a girl. Usually it would be the youngest. But I will say that sometimes it's like inside out, you know, the second inside out, sometimes the anger emotion hides the sadness emotion. Okay. So sometimes the tears disguise themselves in a punch or something.
Right,
you know?
Right.
Yeah. Facts.
Right. Yeah.
That's you go funny, cry man. At home. Yeah. So now you talk about the other thing that I like was the Midwest cheap. And so I like to talk about my family as being Louisiana. We're from Louisiana, Charlie. So Louisiana cheap. So, for example, when I was in high school, you talk about, you know, wearing secondhand clothes. Uh-huh. My parents would shop at a store in Los Angeles where they could buy clothes that were slightly irregular. And so you might have a shirt with one hole for a cufflink. The other side doesn't have the hole. One button's off. I had these pants, Charlie, in high school, these jeans that I got from the slightly irregular store. And every time I opened my yearbook, I was voted the tallest and best athlete. But you can see one pants leg is like a 34. The other is about a 33 and a half. And every time I look at that picture in my yearbook, it reminds me of the freaking slightly irregular crap that only I knew about, because it was, you know, you couldn't really tell, but yeah, I knew the crap that I was wearing to school, man.
Right, that is so cool. Was the name slightly irregular? Was that the name
of the store? I mean, that was I forget the name of the store, but that was part of the title. It was like, you know, something store slightly irregular, you know. And so they're cheap, but they would stock up on that stuff, man, and tell me, don't worry about it, boy. Ain't nobody gonna notice it. I don't know what you're tripping on. Anybody gonna notice that?
It's true. It's true, though. No one's gonna notice. There are some times where I'm worried about like what I'm wearing out, because you know, I go do shows and I don't always pay attention when I pack my suitcase, and I'm like, I'm like, these jeans are dirty. Like this past weekend, like I brought my work jeans, you know, and so they're brown.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at them in the green room. And I'm like, do these look like dirty brown or like they're like, you know, those sort of rustic jeans you get?
Yeah.
And everyone's like, they look dirty. I was like, they won't be able to see from the stage, you know?
Right. Yeah. And you talked about
buy a new pair, you know, you don't want that.
Yeah, but you also talked about the hand-me-downs and neighbors just giving y'all clothes to so many kids. But walking around in a Harvard Crew T-shirt. I mean, but now that would be almost fashionable, right? These kinds of little catchy, whatever the salty dog thing that you're walking around in, man. But that would be almost like a solid fashion statement now. The way T-shirts are.
Yeah, it's almost like at some point doing the thrifting or whatever, that became, which I think is good, that became fashionable. Like the, because then people got all hippie about the fast fashion, which is probably good because fast fashion, it's not really good for much. But then people start going to Goodwill like as a, for reals, for fashion purposes.
Legit.
Yeah. And then finally, and I don't want to belabor, but it brought back so many memories for me, especially the cheap part. Oh man, you just thought, because we used to, once my parents found out about chicken a la king and these meals that you can, just sloppy joes, these meals you can feed an army of people for like $4 on. That was a staple in our household. But Halloween, how much of the DIY, do-it-yourself stuff, did you guys actually get Halloween costumes, or was it like, you know, you better be creative and come up with something that we have available?
Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, first of all, I want to hear about your Halloween. What did you guys do?
Well, I mean, I got so tired of being a hobo one year, you know, cutting up some old T-shirts. So one year we had the Halloween parade at school, Manhattan Place Elementary School, South Central, all black school. I came, so there was the only thing left. I got stuck at home by myself, so, and I couldn't come up with something, Charlie, Chris. So I got stuck with this Cinderella wig, like a yellow wig. I got my sister's blue dress and my low top black Converse, and I went as a girl. I put on the dress. I with my size 12 Converse, size 11 Converse at 2 years old, and the wig on with the little pigtails, and I marched around, and I got the biggest laugh out of everybody.
I never knew this.
I
never knew
it. I was RuPaul before RuPaul. I'm this big, tall, black dude dressed in drag, and they, man. So that was like the highlight of my creativity. What about you guys, man? Give me some.
First of all, I love this sort of father son duo because Chris is learning new stuff about you while I'm learning new stuff about you. That's what I love about this family stuff, man. But I'm not gonna be able to top that. But my mom actually, she would sew the stuff. So, and she was really good. Like she would, yeah. She had like some, she had fabrics, and whatnot. And so she made one year I was a shark. And then when you're a costume one year and then, you know, your brother knows what he's going to be next year. You know what I mean?
Pass it down. Right.
Yeah. She put work into those costumes. So, you know, and then after the first few years, then it's just sort of a hodgepodge of things going on. But my mom, she made some real good costumes. I was a shark. I was Peter Pan. I was a pumpkin. But let's see here. And then, of course, once we got into high school or not high school. Geez, how long was I trick or treating? Grade school. You'd figure out your own costume, but I was never as good as what my mom made. I usually was just pulling out like a football helmet and going as a football player. I was never as brave as you. Going with
the cross dressing thing. Yeah, that's, man, like 10, 11 years old. Yeah.
What was the response?
Oh, they loved it. They loved, you know, everybody. I was going for the laughs. Everybody just laughed. Yeah, you know, this big tall dude with the wig and the pigtails and the dress and the big feet, the big 11 black Converse low top. You know, tennis shoes. They went crazy over it, man. So, but now. The other thing, Charlie, I wanted to touch is your best-selling author, The Midwest Survival Guide, released in 2021, New York Times bestseller list. How does that happen, man? I mean, I got a book that I'm about to publish on my high school Crenshaw, The Crenshaw Chronicles, Daryl Strawberry and all these great athletes, Wendell Tyler, play Super Bowl winner, the group Climax, the Men All Pause, Meet Me in the Ladies Room, all these great people that went to Crenshaw. And so I wrote a book about that. And the publishing part is the challenge. But for you, best-selling author. I mean, how break that down to me? How you were able to kind of did you get a publisher right away? Did you self-publish? Did you get a following first?
Yeah, and that was really in some ways maybe it's a little misleading because I had the following, you know, and this was also 2020, and so you had the pandemic going on, and then people. You know, so people had a bunch of extra money at that time because the government, I think, was giving out. I'm sitting here trying to take down the best-selling author thing, but I had a following, and then what? So that helps because then you say pre-buy this book or buy it on this day, and then that can help it get onto that bestseller list, and also the list you choose to get it on. Like, there's a bunch of different bestseller lists, and then depending on the category of the book. So I think then mine was in the travel section or whatever. So I think, it did the thing, but I'm not exactly sure in the totality of books or in the section, because yours would be autobiography.
No, it's more, it's a bunch of different vignettes, different sports biographies. It's not me per se, but it's about a bunch of different kind of personalities and athletes and entertainers and musicians that went through Crenshaw High School.
Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. So is this like all from your perspective?
No, I interviewed like 35 different people over the last 2 years. I wrote it with a guy by the name of Charlie Rose, and Charlie passed away from cancer last September, but he wrote a book on Phil Jackson and then Kobe Bryant, the Lakers. He's written about 25 to 30 great sports books. So we collaborated and wrote the first couple of chapters. Then he got ill. So I wound up doing the rest myself. So I wound up interviewing about 30 of the 35 different people that we talked about. And all my sons, four of my five sons, went to Crenshaw either, you know, for a couple of years at least. Josiah, who's on the Gills Arena. But so I interviewed them in terms of their perspective, you know, and following their dads. When we all played for the same coach, my coach that I played for, they played for. he was there like 40 years, you know. So anyway, so yeah, it's an interesting book. I think it'll do well. It's just, yeah, just, you know, figuring out what's the best approach. Go ahead, Chris.
I wanted to give Charlie some flowers, right? New York Times bestselling author. Then I see the Emmy Award winning TV journalist. I don't know too many people that have both of those on their resume. Tell me, what did you win your Emmy for? What type of journalism were you into? I'd like to hear about that, Charlie.
Yeah. Well, this was it's called The Cost of Water. And I was a reporter at KDAF in Dallas, Texas. I left Wisconsin when I was, you know, right out of college and kind of went around the country for 10 years doing various forms of journalism and whatnot. And so anyways, I get over to Dallas and that was sort of where I did more of the traditional type journalism. But it basically looked at water. And at the time, Texas was in a drought. And yet you would go past these homes and see these big fountains and you'd see green grass and everything. So you're kind of like, well, if we're in a drought, like, why is that happening? And because there's so that brought up the question, why do we use water in ways that we do? And what is the actual cost of water? And are we putting the proper value on water for what it brings to people? And also, economically speaking, if we're spending water on these things, which may not have a lot of use, is there enough for this stuff, which does? So it's one of those kind of topics that, you know, can put you to sleep real quick. And so we tried to find a way to make it, like, you know, sort of engaging a little bit by adding, you know, kind of humor and different graphics and all that sort of stuff.
Well, and that's the other thing about you, Charlie, is that you do a great job, man, of combining social consciousness issues with the humor. So you do the Manitowoc Minute. And I was you talking about AI and all that. But where did that come from? Just the social consciousness in terms of the household. Was that mom? Was that dad? Was it a combination? Was it just kind of the vibe that was in the Barron's household growing up? But talk about that and your goal with that and what you're trying to do.
Yeah, you know, my parents, they raised us Catholic. And with that, you got guilt. You got a lot of guilt, you know. It comes in thick. And what we're trying to do in life, as you can see, is we're trying to get out of purgatory. So several ways you can get out of purgatory. One of them is grandma can say a rosary for you.
Okay.
But then beyond that, it's pretty much good deeds. So we're in a good deed situation here.
Gotcha.
I'm kind of kidding. But, you know, mostly like my parents, you know, they always just taught you being in a big family, honestly, is what it is. Like you learn very quickly that this world is not about you. This world is about, there's sort of a bigger thing at play, and your job is to contribute in the ways that you can. So, you know, once you get like a platform, the way I have gotten it or whatever, you feel like if you see something that's not adding up and you see people getting hurt over it, you know, you just want to do the best you can do to make that right. And in case of the whole data center situation, I just want people to be informed and then for people to make the decision people want to make. Because as it was, as it is, you know, these small towns were kind of getting overrun and still are getting overrun by billion-dollar corporations. And it's not the billion-dollar corporation's home. It's the home of Wisconsinites, and they should be the one making the decisions.
So yeah, but you're informing, but you're entertaining. I mean, you're it's funny as hell. Just, I mean, the character that you use to disseminate that information. I mean, it's funny as hell. I mean, it's brilliant in terms of kind of along the John Stewart. I don't want to put a label on it, but it's the political humor, but Bill Maher. But it's funny, irreverent, but it's also makes you think about what's going on at the same time. And that's a great combination to approach it with.
Well, that's very, very kind of you. Thank you. Yeah. And it's, that's all we're just mostly, I would love to not even, have to do that stuff and just stick with, Straight up funny, but sometimes you just gotta put your neck out there a little bit if it's gonna help other people. So,
all right, well, let's get to what we got you here for, because our producer Mona's Khan will have a seismic whatever.
Championship. You know, that's not something you just forget. You remember every single detail, like where you were. Even what you ate.
I mean, I was so excited, I ordered a 50-piece. Wasn't a good idea.
But most importantly, what it meant. But this Bucks championship in 1987, the one you probably never even heard of, this is the one that changed everything. Because without this one, there is no Dirk in Dallas. There is no Joker in Denver. There is no Giannis in Milwaukee. But look, if you're going to have a tournament that changes the course of basketball history, you are going to need one heck of a main event. And 1987, that was a year full of iconic matchups. Magic versus Bird in the finals. LT versus Elway in the Super Bowl. But this tournament was more than just goats and heavyweights. Found that on Amazon. This was a battle of superpowers, a battle of global proportions, a battle of basketball supremacy. Oh, there it is. Bango. This is the 1987 McDonald's Open.
You narrated the great Bucks versus the World. It's the newest Behind the Bucks podcast series. How much did you know about that? Did you know anything about that? What did you learn about that? It's probably kind of fascinating for a Bucks fan like yourself.
Oh my gosh, I gotta tell you, I had so much fun diving into this because first of all, 1987.
Yeah.
It's the year I was born. So, okay. You know, yeah, I was established in 1987. And so that was kind of an initial thing. But also, like, no, the McDonald's Open, it's not something I really thought about. But as Monas, shout out to Monas. He did a bang up job with this thing.
He did.
As I was like reading about it, doing the research, you know, reading the scripts and everything. You're really like on this journey of how the NBA changed and how it got sort of the international, acclaim that it has now by incorporating players from around the world. All started with this kind of moment. So, and the fact that it happens in Milwaukee with the 87 Bucks and everything like that. I mean, it's kind of a cool story. And then on top of that, you think about like, where's the world at this time? You got like the Cold War stuff, you know, Rocky IV is kind of isn't quite out yet even. So you got that whole Russia versus the U.S., the Soviet Union versus the U.S. stuff. And so it's just it combines like history of the world with sort of the history of the NBA and where we are, like Giannis. In a lot of ways, could be argued as here now because of the McDonald's Open, you know?
Yeah.
Facts.
So, yeah, I mean, what did you think of the McDonald's Open when it was first happening? Was it kind of like a big deal in Milwaukee? Can you remember back to that? Or did you kind of hear about it, you know, later? How did that work
out? Well, you know, I was traded. We had Terry Cummings on. His interview, I think, drops probably today, right, Chris? But we had Terry Cummings on talking about it on the show. And so at the time, I mean, we didn't have a whole lot of respect in the 80s. I mean, we weren't just enamored with European players. A few of them had kind of showed up and they were usually big and slow. It was a different time. I fell in love with a guy, Krešimir Čosić. I used to get the Mormon channel in Los Angeles on UHF, channel 78 or something. And they okay. And so the Mormons, they would show BYU games. And they had a 7'2", 7'6", 6'11", Krešimir Čosić
but he would handle the ball. He was Pete Maravich with the long hair and the floppy socks. He was shooting threes. He was smoking two packs of cigarettes a day, but he was just this old burly Yugoslavian dude. It was Yugoslavia at the time. And so he was the one guy got picked in the seventh round or whatever by the Lakers, but decided to go overseas. And he coached Tony Kukoc and Vlade Divac, and all these guys came up under him in his program over in Europe. And so I wasn't, you know, but Bob McAdoo, he was an idol of mine growing up, especially with the Buffalo Braves days, led the league in scoring 30 points a game. I played with Sarunas Marcellonis, Chris, when Chris and I, we were in, the family was in Golden State, Don Nelson and Golden State. So Sarunas came in his first year, his rookie year. I was there and got to know him well. And one funny story, so he didn't speak any English, you know, Russian is all he spoke. And he used to always tell us that the Lithuanians were the second best basketball players in the world behind American blacks. He would just say that. We're the second best in the world behind American blacks. It's the Lithuanians. Like, okay, whatever. But in practice one day, Chris, Charlie, Don Nelson was the coach. Don Nelson Jr., his son, was responsible for communicating with Sarunas, but Nelly Jr. didn't speak any Russian either. And so we were going through something. So Nelson Sr. says, Donnie, tell him to run through the pick harder. So Donnie goes, you run through pick harder. And Nelly was like, oh, this is great. Oh wow. This is, you know, I could have done that. Wow. You know, but when the earthquake happened in 89, I was there in San Francisco, the Bay Area earthquake that postponed the World Series. I was getting ready to watch the Oakland A's play the San Francisco Giants, had my crab ready across the street, and then the earthquake hit. But Sarunas Marcellonis, who had gone through so much in war-torn areas that he lived in, he went out immediately and helped dig cars from under rubble and help people. I mean, he was out there, you know, hands on helping people out. So it was a different sensibility. And, you know, I'm trying to stay out of falling buildings and all that and figure out what's going on. He was out there actually helping people. So anyway, to answer your question, man, but it was a big deal because it opened the door, the floodgates, really, for all these great European players to come over here and do what they're doing. So, yeah.
Well, and as you said, how he raced out there to help people too, it also adds like a whole different like perspective. Yeah. And you know, that's got to also translate into actually playing the game in a lot of ways too. You almost play with like a different heart in a lot of ways.
Yeah. They had a serious edge. And that's the thing about the Euros, Chris, Vlade and Tony Kukoc. I mean, they gone through so much. So they get these Americans trying to talk trash to them and trying to intimidate them. And these guys have watched bodies being blown up. You know, you start thinking about it in that context.
Yeah. Well, I think also MJ, the Euros kind of, they have this sort of reputation for being soft, but I don't think they're soft. I think they are choosing to not go to a place where they could easily go and be angry and all that, because they've seen so much. They've seen dead bodies. They've seen people get killed. So they choose peace. Like, I played in Europe. I played in Russia, Turkey, the Middle East. I mean, they truly, those people over there, by and large, for the most part, really want just a peaceful lifestyle. They're all about family. Everywhere I went. And so when I hear the talk about the Euros, like they're soft, I'd be like, man, them dudes grew up in Serbia and Bosnia and some of these places that you guys, like I would not be comfortable stepping foot in because I know what time it is over there. You feel me?
That's an interesting point to bring up. So when you're playing over there, was the trash talk different? I guess it was a different language, but does sort of that, those insides of the game, like the trash talk, that kind of thing, the physicality of it change at all, or is it kind of the same?
For me, in the 90s, in the early 2000s, when I was over there, the physicality was amongst the most physical that I'd ever played basketball in. It was almost as if the ref swallowed the whistles and didn't give the Americans no calls, because it was tough. The pace of the game was fast. The physicality was tough. And then speaking to your trash talk point, it was almost non-existent, not only because of the language barrier, but because it's such an intense game and an intense scenario. And it's basically two Americans, right, on each team. So you're kind of outnumbered. And trash talking isn't necessarily the smartest thing to do, because those dudes would be waiting for you after the game.
Right. Yeah.
You got to be, hey, Charlie, you got to be right here with it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yes. You ain't home. You're on our turf right now. Yeah.
I'm in Moscow. What am I right. going to do? I mean,
yeah. Right. Yeah. The standard is thrown out the door there. It's, right. Yeah. It's, yeah. You're playing by their rules and you're learning it got that to. Way. You
know? Yeah. You have to. And so speaking of the Bucks. So you're like, what, 14, 15 when the Bucks make the Eastern Conference Finals. So just give me some of your fondest memories of those Bucks teams, the Big Dog and all, and Ray Allen and that crew.
Oh, yeah. There were Ray Allen, Sam Cassell, Big Dog. I mean, so me and my buddies, we were big Bucks fans, and it was a different fan experience back then because we were the Bradley Center was so tall, like yeah. You got up to the top row and I never sat down below really, but you could get $5 seats back then on certain nights, you know, and you could go up there. But as you were looking down, you would almost get a little motion sick. You know, because it was so high up there. So that's like, I would remember like kind of like from seventh grade to like through high school, you know, we would be going over there. And that was always the thing I remember is there were certain nights where you could get $5 tickets and we would always we'd go to Major Goolsby's. We would get like a burger. As we got later into high school, we tried to order beer. It never worked, you know, and then we would go over there, but it was a cool time, to do that. And then you kind of like go through, and then I left, of course, and then, came back and, we had a championship here, probably 2 years after I came back after not being here. So that was kind of cool. And then we would go back to the stadium, me and that same group of friends, and the tickets were significantly a little bit more than $5. But it is kind of interesting to see just the Bucks franchise move just in my lifetime. You know, it's been kind of fun.
Yeah. No, well, you know, and the Midwest people, man, you've tapped into something, Charlie. 5.7 billion views on YouTube and, you know, a couple of millions of followers and all that, man. Did you, when you were starting this out, did you ever think that it would become this big?
No, not at all. I mean, I put out the first Man to Walk Minute and I named it after a guy who was, in the audience of a stand-up show I was in. I was at the Comedy Store in Los Angeles and I was doing, yeah, I lived in Los Angeles for a few years. And I says, anyone from the Midwest? A bunch of people raise their hand. I says, anyone from Wisconsin? This guy says, I'm from Manitowoc. And, you know, I go, what do you think of LA? He goes, honestly, the old fashioned suck eggs. And so I named the Manitowoc Minute after that guy. I got to see if I can find that guy somewhere. But
that's funny.
But yeah. I bring that up to say I just named it after this guy in the audience. I didn't expect to do another episode, but that was the video that took off. I was like, oh, now I got to do another episode. And what I think I stumbled upon was just sort of a Midwest audience that wanted more and maybe didn't feel seen at a particular time or something like that. You know?
Yeah. Well, being from Los Angeles, when I came to Milwaukee, it was different. I'm not going to, you know, it's still different. But what I found, mm-hmm. Charlie, is that, I mean, Midwest people, I always tell people in LA this. And Midwest people crack me up because every winter they complain about the weather. Oh my God, it's so cold. You know, they complain about the winters every year and they've been through it for like 40, 50 years, but it's always about how cold and how much snow and all that. But the people, my point is that the people are the salt of the earth and they're in Milwaukee, in the Midwest, bad as the weather is or whatever, because they want to be, because they love it here, because of whatever the virtues are that they tap into, man. And I appreciate the way that you really kind of tapped into the whole vibe of the Midwest. I was at
I was at my dentist's office in Milwaukee, in Wauwatosa, Tom Tongas, and his sister is his dental assistant. And so I had a partial denture or something break off, and I was going to do the podcast, and he brought me in that day on an emergency, and I actually taped it and sent it to Modus and Chris and their crew. I'm sitting there taping it because they're talking to each other. I got my mouth open. He's like, could you pass me that guy over there? Yeah, give me that guy right there. That guy right there. Hey, here's this guy here. Yeah, that guy right there. Let's see here.
Can you help me
out with this here? Yeah, okay. Keep her open, Marcus. Keep her open. Keep her open. Don't close her yet. And it was the beauty of the Midwest. I had my phone. I recorded the whole thing. And I still look at it today because it's just so endearing, you know, just the way the people are. Yeah. But you've tapped into it, man, and congratulations to you. What's going on with you now right now? Anything out there you getting ready to do, want to do, want to plug? What's going on with you?
Oh, yeah. No, we're doing the new show now on tour. We're doing it's the new tour. The special Neighborly is out on YouTube, as you mentioned. So now we're on the road again doing a whole new hour. It's called the Lost and Found Tour. So that's been fun. And this podcast, obviously, about the 1987 McDonald's Open. That's going to be cool. But yeah, that's really it. Just working on stand up and enjoying life. And I did want to ask you real quick if you have time.
Sure.
When you first moved to the Midwest from California,
Milwaukee.
What was the thing that stood out? Yes. I mean, you can go Milwaukee specifically, but I don't know if you wanted to, because you've also traveled around the Midwest as a region. So either regionally or city specific Milwaukee, what was like the biggest difference aside for like the weather? Was there some that stood out about the people to you?
And again, it was the genuineness of the people. I lived in an apartment in Whitefish Bay, and my neighbors were this couple, older white couple, probably in their 80s, Mr. and Mrs. Moths. And they're in their 80s. The husband is not in great health. And every week, once a week, I'd get a yell, you know, Mark, can you come and help me pick Mr. Moths up and put him back in his chair? And I go into their apartment, Mr. Moths would be like laying down, like, you know, and I have to pick it. Come on, old guy, I got you. I pick him up. But she was just so appreciative. So she cooked me different, you know, some different German type dishes and all that. But it was just, you know, it was a friendliness about the people that just really stood out to me. And initially, I didn't like it. You know, I'm LA. I'm looking for the parties and the clubs and all that.
Right.
But after about two or three years, I really started to appreciate the fact that they're here because they want to be here. They're not going anywhere. They don't care if you like it, don't like it. They don't give a crap. Your feelings about the Midwest, they could care less what you feel about Milwaukee. They love it, and they're going to be here. So you might as well get used to it, you know. And you want to get the hell out of here. And the other thing is that they appreciate effort, and they don't – I won't say they don't care about the reaching the mountaintop and winning the championships, but they're not obsessed with that. And that's why I came back, because I got that feeling of appreciation for what we did, even though we lost to Larry Bird and Dr. J every year in the playoffs and never got to the finals. They appreciate the fact that we tried as best we could, and they don't, you know, unlike New York fans or somebody else, you guys, you're losers, you're failed. They appreciate that, the fact that you gave an honest effort. And that to me is what the Midwest is all about, man.
Oh, that's awesome. That was like, well, I thought you were going to say the what's with the cheese curds, but that was a really nice, thoughtful answer. And I love that, you know, you were just being called through the like living room wall.
Mark, I need you, Mark.
I love that. That's so Midwest.
That was a great experience. But look, man, we appreciate you, man. Keep doing what you're doing. And
thank you guys.
We can circle back with you. You know, when we see what's going on. Quickly, thoughts on Giannis and the Bucks, and anything, any observations you want to share with us on these current Bucks and what's going on, and how you're feeling about this?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're really it's gonna start this week. There was just big long winning streak, and Giannis is gonna be like, "Hey, look at this," you know, and it's all gonna go positively,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
I was saying that the Packers were gonna win the Super Bowl up until 4 weeks ago. So yeah. I don't know if you wanna take my gambling advice, but I got high hopes.
No, that's a good deal, man. All right, man. Charlie Behrens, we appreciate you, man. Narrator
thank of you so much.
The world. Check it out on Behind the Bucks podcast. It's a new series. So thanks, man, for joining here, District.